Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is engineer and studio owner Billy Klein. But first, I'd like to talk about the 8 social media mistakes that a lot of artists and bands and record labels, record execs, songwriters, producers, engineers, and generally music people tend to make. And they're not alone. A lot of businesses make these same mistakes. So let's go down the list. The first one is, and probably the biggest mistake, is not having any strategy at all. You need a social strategy in order to really use it effectively as promotion. And the way you do that is by thinking what you want that social media to do for you. For most of us, if we're just using it, we just want it to keep in touch with people. But if you're using it strategically, you want to use it to help you with your promotion. You want to gain more fans. You want them to buy from you. You want to inform them about what you're doing. So you need a strategy in how to do that. And the easiest way to do that is focus on your website first. So the website comes first. Your mailing list comes second, is the most important. And from there, all of your social media has to point to your website. This is easier said than done because it does take some time, it does take some effort, and it does take some thought. Basically, you need this in order to be the most efficient and get the most out of your social media promotion. So that's number one, not having a strategy. Number two is having too many social media accounts, being on too many platforms. And of course, there are so many platforms to choose from, and there are more coming all the time. The best thing is to choose one platform if you're just starting and get really good at it. Choose YouTube, choose Facebook, choose Twitter, which are the big three. Maybe it's Vine you want. Maybe it's Instagram. It doesn't matter. Choose one, get really good at it, establish yourself there, gain some followers, then expand and move on to another one. Now, this is kind of the opposite from what we used to tell people. Now, originally, when social media was first getting going and was first being used as a promotional tool, the idea was to be everywhere, everywhere that you could be. And now that basically means that you would be spread so thin you wouldn't be able to get anything done. So now the best thing is to just concentrate on one platform at a time. Usually you won't have time, you won't have the available content to be able to do more than 3 or 4, even when you get good at it. And you find there are some that you have to leave out of the mix. And that's okay too. So for instance, you'd probably want to go where most of your fans are. If you find that your fans are on Instagram and not on Twitter, then of course you'd leave Twitter out and you'd go on Instagram. Almost everyone needs to be on YouTube and also on Facebook, because Facebook is getting stronger. It's not getting weaker. And even though it keeps on changing, it's still the big dog in the fight. So that's kind of where you have to be. So don't have too many accounts. Number three is don't buy fake followers or fake views. The reason why is, although it may look impressive, you can see through this in a second. So if someone really wants to find out, they can find out that you've bought those followers. It used to be that if you wanted to sign with the record label, for instance, the record label would gauge how well you're doing and what kind of audience you had by the number of views, by the number of followers that you had, by number of friends. And of course, if you jack those totals up, then you'd be more attractive to them. So many people game the system that record labels, agents, managers, everyone that counts can see right through it and they can tell. So number three, don't pay for fake followers. Number four, only concentrating on yourself. And this is a no-no because it gets too promotional at that point. And really, what you want to do is include other people, include your fans, include your followers, ask them questions, give them polls and surveys, reach out to them. Make sure that it's more than just 100% promotion, that you're providing information, that you're providing good content as well. You don't want to keep on saying, we. We have something new. Listen to this. You want to add content. You want there to be a reason for people to come back and look for your posts. Number five, don't have too many or irrelevant hashtags. Irrelevant hashtags are about the same as no hashtag at all. And what that means is if you have a hashtag that says something like hashtag, I hate this venue, well, that does you no good because there's not many people that are going to find it. Also, it doesn't do you too much good if you overload the post with an excessive number of hashtags. And the reason why is it's been found that on Twitter, for instance, if you have more than two, the engagement actually goes down. The other thing you do is you use up so much space and so many characters that you really can't get any information in the post. So having irrelevant or excessive hashtags is also not a good thing. Number six, too many posts in too short of time. No one likes their newsfeed dominated by one person posting. So you're better off to have six posts that are paced out throughout the day rather than six posts within an hour. So don't have too many posts at one time. Now, if you're at an event, let's say you're backstage or you go to a concert and you're tweeting, for instance, the best thing to do is to warn your followers that this is going to happen. So at least they know it's coming and they could ignore these posts if they happen. So if you're going to do a lot of posts in a short period of time, warn everybody. Number seven, not proofreading your posts. And this is a really easy thing to do, especially in the heat of the moment when you want to get something out in a hurry or you're emotional about something. It's easy to fire off a post and then be sorry about it later. Generally speaking, remember that people do judge you on your grammar and they do judge you on your spelling. Although it's all right to have something occasionally off, generally speaking, you want to make sure that you read and reread that post before you send it. I try to read everything at least three times before I send it out. Even though I think I may have gotten it perfect the first time, I usually find a mistake or two, and one that'd be very embarrassing if I didn't read my posts. So I would recommend that you proofread and at least do one additional pass after you've written it. And finally, not being social enough. And what that means is when people reach out to you, you should reach back. If they're asking you a question, answer it. If they're commenting on something, join in with the comment. The worst thing you can do is post and then not interact afterwards. Now, there are times when you can actually do it and it's appropriate, but for the most part, you should always interact if you can. Probably the worst thing is if you're intermittent about how you do this. If people know that you're only going to broadcast on one platform, at least they know that. So if you do engage and then don't for a long period of time, that does more harm than good. So those are the eight social media mistakes that many artists and bands make. If you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. Don't forget about my new coaching program. It's 101 Mixing Tricks, Big Studio Tricks for the Small Studio. You can go to 101mixingtricks.com to learn more. Also, take your career to the next level with my Music Prosperity Breakthrough program at musicprosperitybreakthrough.com. It's Music Prosperity Breakthrough, all one word. Next, I want to talk about a common email that I receive, and it usually goes something like this. I have a home studio, and I want to make sure that my neighbors don't hear when I'm cranking my Marshall. How do I isolate my studio? The problem is you can't, or at least you can't do it inexpensively. People think that they can do it with just putting up some foam, for instance, acoustic foam, and that never works. The only way that you can isolate your studio, and sometimes it's just in a bedroom, for instance, I don't want to disturb my wife sleeping in the next room. Yeah, good luck with that. What it would take to isolate a room would probably take more room than you have in the room itself. It's brute force in order to do it. And basically what you need is big walls with air spaces. It costs a lot of money to do any kind of isolation. There's no way around it. No one has found any way around this. And all studios that have great isolation do it this way. It's double walls with an airspace in between. It's a lot of glues and screws, very labor intensive. And you'll find that that's the only way that you can actually pull this off. Now, on the other hand, it's a little different if you're talking about acoustically treating your space. And that you can do fairly easily and fairly inexpensively. There are three basic components to treating your acoustic space. The first one is acoustic panels. And basically, these are 2x4 panels that you put up along the wall. They're 2x4 because the acoustic treatment, the compressed fiberglass or the rock wool or whatever it might be, usually comes in 2x4 sheets. So you put a frame around it, and that becomes your acoustic panel. Very easy to build. You can build it yourself. And as a matter of fact, I'll include a link at the bottom of the page here that you can follow to a video of how to do your own. You can buy them as well. There's lots of companies that sell acoustic panels. Realtraps.com is one. Radi Acoustics is another one. GIK Acoustics, ATS Acoustics. All of them sell acoustic panels that you can buy, and they're not all that expensive. The next really important building block is the bass trap. And usually you can't have enough bass traps, especially in small home studios, because there's usually a problem on the low end. And bass traps only work on the bass between about 40 and 200 cycles. Put them in the corners, and it smooths out your low end response. Usually the more you have, the better, in a small studio anyway. In a larger studio, you have to strategically space them out, and usually there are formulas that you use, although there's always some trial and error with it. But that's the second type of building block for acoustic treatment. The third one is diffusers, and diffuser does just that. It diffuses the sound. When the sound hits the diffuser, it gets sprayed all over the place. It doesn't reflect right back where it came. And that's important because these are the things that actually make acoustic problems in the room. When you have things that are bouncing off, and especially they're bouncing off at the same angle they came in at. There's two types. There's 2D and 3D, and 2D does it just in one plane, and 3D does it in two of them. In small studios, you usually find that you don't need diffusers, and you can just use acoustic panels instead. Usually you'll find diffusers in bigger studios, and that's good because they're the most expensive of the three building blocks. But if you're going to treat your room, these are the things you need. They're not very expensive. If you only have a little bit of money, and that's $100 or $200, either buy or build your own acoustic panels, and you'll find that they'll make a really big difference. However, if you're looking for isolation, it takes brute force. It takes a lot of money and a lot of space and a lot of time. So that's usually out of the question for most small studio owners. My guest today is Billy Klein, who's the co-owner of a studio that may very well set the trend for new studio concepts. Billy's Hybrid Studios combines a traditional studio with a large format console and a video soundstage, making it a one-stop shop for modern artists that are more and more dependent on video. Billy also has an impressive list of credits, having worked with artists like Adele, Keith Urban, and Shakira, among many others. I spoke with him via Skype from a studio in Santa Ana, the heart of Orange County, California. I find it interesting that your studio, that Hybrid, is really just that. It's a hybrid, and where you have a soundstage along with a recording studio, traditional recording studio, and that's kind of cool. I mean, that seems to be where things at least should be going, don't you think?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely unique. It's it gives us a whole nother revenue stream that most recording studios don't have. And it's like what you said, it's hybrid in multiple ways. We're using analog and digital gear, and then also we're doing video and audio all out of one building. So yeah, I definitely think that with the decline of the recording business, there's still video production business coming in, and the two offset each other very well and help keep it at a pretty level workflow.
How'd you come to the conclusion that this was something that you wanted to do? Because I mean, you know, most people that are audio people just wouldn't think of that.
Yeah. Okay. So I was working for Sony Music and kind of hit like a glass ceiling there. And it seemed like the only way to kind of break through was going to be opening my own space. And I guess I had a longtime buddy who was going to be opening up a soundstage by himself. And it kind of was a good time to join up together and it, you know, kind of the kick I needed to actually start this place. But if I didn't have my buddy, I'd probably still just be doing strictly audio engineering, you know, still up in LA and all that.
Were you going to open the studio in LA?
Well, you know, the market's really saturated there. So that seemed kind of difficult to do. Me and my buddy, the other owner, are actually from Orange County. So we thought we could come down to Orange County and kind of build an LA room in Orange County, trying to fill a need that, you know, that was kind of there.
But Orange County has not only had one music scene, there's lots of different music scenes. I mean, there's punk and metal and ska's come out of there, and all sorts
of... Lots of reggae.
Great bands, no doubt. Social Distortion, The Offspring, Avenged Sevenfold. You know, you can go on and on. The bands, the artists that have come from Orange County, I don't think many people appreciate that.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that's it's kind of the misconception, because there is a lot of talent here. And I think what tends to happen from my point of view is most of the talent kind of thinks that they have to go to LA because there's nothing local that kind of fits what they need. So that's kind of part of why we tried to open an LA room in Orange County, is we're kind of trying to break that misconception of, hey, you got to go to LA to go record in a nice space or something like that. Because like you said, a lot of these musicians that you just mentioned, they're local to us. And so if we could save them an hour drive, it's and offer the same quality equipment, why not come to us?
Yeah, I mean, you got an SSL in there. And do I understand this correctly? This used to be at Cornerstone Studios?
Yeah, it used to be at Cornerstone. It was originally bought by the New York Hit Factory. They originally ordered it from SSL, and it, you know, since it's such like a legacy board, it has so many stories. And I've been told by Bruce Millett, the desk doctor, who's well known in the whole Southern California area. I'm trying to think, like Billy Joel and Fleetwood Mac, and I'm at a loss, but some significant sized artists have been through this console and been on this console. And so that's a really cool part of owning a legacy console, is just the history.
Well, I mean, the reason why I bring up Cornerstone is I used to work there. And so I worked on the console as well. And I can remember when Fleetwood Mac, you know, booked in when the studio just opened.
So. Yeah, exactly. That would be amazing. You know, did it have Ultimation and all the whole Total Recall system and all that at Cornerstone?
Not at the time, as I recall. But, you know, there was an interesting story about Cornerstone. So they spent a long time building it, and it was in an industrial park, a small industrial park. And they're ready for, and actually it was Fleetwood Mac came in on the first session, and they couldn't work the first day because there was this pounding in the background that was constant. Boom. Boom, boom. And I couldn't figure out what was going on. And it was so low that they just couldn't record. So they went outside, they looked around, walked around, and here there was a metal shop that was right across the way that, I don't know if people forgot about it, they couldn't hear or whatever, but it had this big metal press that they kept on using. So they tried to pay for the metal shop to leave. They tried to do whatever they can in the metal shop. Yeah. Definitely wouldn't bend. And finally, they had to actually put an isolation stand under the metal press. It cost them $25,000 to do this. So they basically floated the floor underneath this metal press, but it solved the problem. But they had to do it. They had to do it fast because they had big clients, you know? So
yeah.
It just goes to show you how those things can happen, you know, without you realizing.
Yeah, you know, we actually had a similar problem and solution. There's, you know, we're in an industrial area, so there's manufacturing. You know, we went on for a year without having any issue, and then all of a sudden we hear this, like, what sounds like rollers. I mean, we're like, okay, well, why is this new sound happening? So we end up going to our neighbor, and they had like the roller on a pallet before. So we offered to give them, like, you know, $20 of rubber feet. And yeah. They put the rubber feet on there, and problem solved.
Oh, lucky you.
Oh, yeah, exactly. At least I didn't have to spend $25,000, you know?
That was cheap, jeez.
Yeah. Oh,
cheap solution.
Yeah, and they're friendly. That's the key, you know? They're willing to work.
Speaking about your studio, you also have a 5-1 mixing room, right?
Yeah, we have a 5-1 mixing room. It's Studio B. It's ironic that you bring that up. We're in the process of putting an AMEC TEC matchless console in there today, actually. So that should be a fun afternoon. And it's kind of a more budget rate room, just to offer as an option to people that don't want to use our main Studio A. But it also achieves a couple extra functions that Studio A doesn't have.
Well, this is cool in a lot of different ways because, first of all, at one short point in my life, I was a sales manager for AMEC in the U.S. So, you know, I know a lot about those consoles, AMIC and TACs. And also, you know, I did a lot of surround mixing for a while. I did 120 different projects, surround projects. And, you know, as before all the work dried up, you know, there used to be a lot of 5-1 work, and then there wasn't. And you were only getting about a third of what, you know, everyone was making before. So it wasn't as lucrative as, you know, a certain point in time. For a couple of years, it was a killer business, so.
I mean, that makes sense. I mean, it's kind of like, ironically, I mean, we have 5-1 in a budget room, you know, just to speak to that, you know?
Sure. No, that makes sense. I was taking a look at your studio, and I noticed that you have, it looks like there's subwoofers that are on the overbridge.
Yeah, dual bridge mounted subs. So basically, me and Hanson's our acoustician. He's from Delta H Designs. He makes great stuff. He's done, you know, rooms people would know about.
Yeah.
But me and him talk about, like, okay, he's fighting for the dual bridge mounted subs, and I'm used to, you know, the single sub underneath the desk kind of thing. And well, when you have Hanson telling you, hey, do it this way, and then let me know, you go ahead and give it a shot, you know, you try it out. And, you know, it's basically working as a three-way with the S3A is basically what it's doing. And, you do get a wider image having dual subs, and, you know, in our room, the size of our control room is huge. So if we want to kind of like add some rumble or boom boom to the back of our control room, we need to really kind of like, I don't want to say like overdo it, but we like to load it up, you know, boost it up kind of thing. And just for those clients looking for that. But for the most part, it's subtle, and it's just acting as a three-way with the S3As. But it does look strange. You don't ever see it anywhere.
Yeah, but, you know, I trust Hanson as well. I've had him on the podcast. I've interviewed him a couple of times, and I actually have a couple of his panels in my room right now. So I'm very familiar with him, and I always felt that he was kind of cutting edge, you know, in terms of acousticians. He just seemed...
I totally agree. Like, and he's also, like, he's doing the math that makes it all work, and it's the functionality's there, but he's also adding an aesthetic factor that you don't necessarily see with a lot of acousticians.
Yeah, that's for sure. Well, it's cool. I'm glad that you got, you know, somebody like that to do it, because, you know, again, cutting edge. It's very cool. You've done some really good projects with some really good artists, right? I heard you did the Adele project.
You know, I was lucky enough to be involved with that. I ended up just assisting on Someone Like You. So I barely missed that Grammy, but, you know, I'm going to run through quick history if you don't mind.
Yeah.
I started at LMU, Loyola Marymount University, right by LAX. They have a recording arts program, 4-year university. It's awesome. A couple of the guys that went through there are now also doing their own thing and making a name for themselves. And, after that, I went and, started interning for Epic Records, first in their A&R department, and then transitioned into their recording studio. And then once I was in the recording studio, that's when I started, obviously after doing all the assisting kind of stuff, started getting to work with like A-list clients and working in a little writing room with, high profile artists was, you know, something I never thought that I would get to. But once I was there, you know, you build a credit list like that. You know, it's just like one day you're doing so and so, and then the next day is another big person. And so being in that kind of recording room, I kind of think gives you a leg up over a lot of other guys who don't have that awesome advantage. You know, so I kind of look at it as a little bit of luck, but a lot of hard work to kind of prove my way along the line to get to that room, you know?
Yeah. Well, let's go back for a second, because you said you started in A&R and then moved to the studio. I mean, that's kind of the opposite, isn't it? The way most people would go.
Yeah. Well, you know, honestly, I was always into recording, and you know, I had done a couple internships throughout school. I worked at a post house, Monkey Land Audio. It was the old Enterprise building in Burbank. Where else? I did a little Westlake studio internship and, you know, but basically what I was trying to do was to try and get into a bigger name, like high profile artists' rooms. And so at Epic's A&R, their senior vice president, was named Mike Flynn, and he was a great guy. He had his own recording room. And so I got to see Mike in the A&R department all the time. And, you know, he'd see me editing on Pro Tools and all that. You know, I'd get there early, so I got like the best desk and, you know, and so I'd get to see him more than the other interns. You know, he saw me working, saw that I was doing it, started a conversation. Are you into that kind of stuff? We need interns at the recording studio. Would you be open to that? Of course. So then I went over there and they had this great engineer named Phil Allen. He's won Grammy, worked on tons of stuff, pretty much my mentor, and he basically showed me like what it takes to go from an intern position to, you know, cutting your teeth and earning your spot kind of thing. So, I mean, it's all, you know, it's always networking and who you know, and I just got lucky enough to, first of all, getting that A&R internship, and then I got lucky enough to, you know, to learn to show up early so then I could talk to Mike, the senior A&R guy, and, you know, so a lot of hard work and also a lot of lucky moments.
I find it interesting that you have the guts kind of to do what you did in to create a traditional studio with, you know, a traditional console involved, because most people are going the other way. I'm not saying there's not a need for it, because there certainly is, and you found a niche, but, you know, most people would say, well, I'm just going to do something, you know, with an overdub room and with, I'll do the rest in the box. And that just seems to be the way it's going. I mean, even for, yeah, you know, some totally of the classic guys, and to go the opposite way is, you know, kind of bucking the trend. So yeah, how did that come about?
You know, okay, so basically there's a couple different ways to like kind of explain that transition. One big reason is the fact that Orange County is an hour south, has a lot of talent, has a great economy, and there's nobody is filling this need that exists. So right there's a hole in that market. So that's one like justification. The other stuff is like what you said with the overdub room and all that kind of stuff, that tends to be what I tell artists that come into us. There's certain things that we feel that fill a niche for, like you said, and, you know, to be completely honest with people, I always say like, come in, do drums, do stuff that you can't do in your garage, in your home studio, come in, do that here, take it back, go do all your overdubs, all vocals. And then when you want to come and mix it in an accurate room, come back and mix it. So I'm not trying to like, you know, talk people into doing a 2-week booking to book an EP, because those days are gone. Yeah. You know, there's no budget for that anymore. So it's like, how can you kind of do it on the cheap and still get a great product? Well, you know, come do drums in a nice room and do your overdubs where you can get away with it, and then mix it somewhere where you have good tools.
Yeah, it makes sense. Definitely. And do you get a lot of mixing work?
Yeah, we get a decent amount of mixing work. That's kind of why I went with the SSL. You know, obviously there's only, I don't want to say obviously only two main choices in consoles, but between, it's like a Neve 8088 or a Neve, you know, 40, whatever, 80 or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the Neve is great for tracking, but after having worked on both of them, the SSL was much more flexible. So like it allowed me to do any combination of anything, you know, in terms of signal flow versus the Neve, which was a little bit more like, this is how the Neve works, yeah. You know?
Yeah. So, yeah. I hear you. The interesting thing about that is that more people can relate to the SSL, I think. You know, they're both British consoles. They both have, you know, their uses. But I guess if you're looking for something more versatile, it's the SSL, really, because it will do everything for you.
I mean, that's kind of my thought process on it.
You have 64 inputs. How often do you use them all?
I mean, it is so rare to use 64 ins. If we were doing like maybe a big band live tracking, multi-tracking all together at once in the live room and ISO rooms, maybe we'd get close to that. But I'd say realistically, we're doing 24 to 32 tracks.
Yeah.
I mean, it's nice to have the extra channels there. I'm not going to just like, I'll throw reverbs over there. I'll do buses over there. You know, I still use them, but we're not using them for inputs or, you know,
yeah,
for their pre's or, you know, it's all small stuff if we're using more than 24 to 32.
But again, you know, speaking of hybrid, everybody does hybrid mixing anymore where you do a certain amount in the box and a certain amount outside the box.
Yeah. You know, and when you start doing that, there's, you open up the amount of possibilities to do everything, you know. I could teach an engineer how I use the room, and then the next guy is just going to, you know, oh, you should use it all. It's hardware inserts, or, you know what I mean? There's just a million ways to get the signal flow between Pro Tools and the console and, you know, each specific piece, that it's just, the amount of options are endless.
Is your soundstage wired as well?
We have a, like a 24 snake tie line that we can kind of throw out there. We have, I don't kind of recommend it for like live performances, because when you're in the actual psych, it's like a bowl.
Yeah.
So the sound that, like, the acoustics within the psych are not ideal. So when we do film people in the, psych for like a music video or something, we'll just be, you know, syncing it up, kind of doing just like a PA, and they're playing to it, just because of how it all bounces around in there. It throws everybody off. So it is, if we needed to do like a reverb mic or something like that, simply that we're mic'd up for, or we're wired for, but I would not recommend to do a live recording in a psych.
Yeah. Oh, you're right. Yeah. I noticed, I was watching the video you did, and I can't remember who it was with, but I noticed that you had a Presonus console in the studio.
Well, yeah. Yeah.
And I'm just curious, are you using that for headphone mixes?
No, for the headphone mixes, we're using the Aviom headphone boxes, you know, that whole thing.
Yeah.
That is more just like it's a PA with wedges, and it's mostly used for pre-production and rehearsal.
Oh.
So if somebody wants to kind of do a discounted video or something of a live performance, you know, we could just, instead of tracking them all through the console and all that, we just will set up a PA, we'll set up the wedges, they'll all play, and we'll just take a live board mix and multi-track that into Pro Tools. So it is kind of strange. You're not the first person to have said something about, point that out, like, why is this in here? But it does serve a couple functions.
Well, I have great respect for Presonus, and I actually wrote a book about that console, so I'm familiar with it. But one of the cool things is the fact that, you know, you can do your own cue mixes from your iPhone. I don't know if you can do it in your model, but on the later ones you can. So again, it kind of makes sense that, you know, if you're going to use it for a cue mix, you know,
that makes total sense.
It could work. Probably the Aviom works better, I think, but
yeah, it's a little bit more reliable and a little bit more user friendly.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, definitely. When you give somebody, just out of curiosity, because I've gone through this and I've talked to lots of engineers and studio owners about this, and I get a variety of responses. When you're doing headphone mixes, and is it a 16 channel Aviom?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, 16 channels. What are you putting on those 16 channels?
I kind of try and tell my engineers to come up with their own little pattern, so that way every time you do a session, you're just like, you know, following your routine. What I tend to do is, you know, kick, snare, and then drums, left, drum, right. So first four channels are the drums. Bass, vocals, and then I'll do BGVs, FX, and then a click and a talkback. So sometimes I need to throw keys on there. You know, I'm not using all 16 the majority of the time. But between, yeah, I mean, but for 80% of what I'm doing, I'm just, you know, kick, snare, drum left, drum right, bass, vocal, effects.
Yeah, yeah. You
know, click, snare, or makes, click and talk back.
Makes perfect sense, because what I've always found is if you fill all those channels up and you give it to a musician and say, oh yeah, here, do your own mix. They can't do it. You know, they always have trouble with the phones, and you have to go out and do it individually. And even then, they'll, you know, they find a way to screw it up. So usually the fewer channels you give them, the easier it is.
That is true. That is very true. I mean, and on, I don't know how familiar you are with the AVOMs, but the biggest like mistake everybody does is they want to turn everything up. And they don't know that there's a master fader on the top right. They want to just like go channel one up, channel two up, channel three, you know?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I totally get it. It's not meant for that type of person. So we give like a little 1 minute lecture on how to work the headphone box.
Yeah. How are you marketing your studio? Because again, it's one of those things, you're kind of unique in your market. You have an interesting market, because there's a lot of different music scenes that are happening. You have up market and down market artists, and you have the soundstage. So yeah, there's a lot of different variables there. So how do you market your studio?
So, okay. So there's a couple different approaches. One of the big things that I am doing with Hybrid is I'm trying to give back to the local music scene. We're involved with like kids performances, with the OC Music Awards, pretty much any event with live music. I'm constantly reaching out to their whoever's putting it on. Their coordinator, and you know, always offering that, hey, Hybrid will sponsor something. What can we do to be involved? Yada yada. Because I think if we can get the whole local music scene behind us, you know, we're all going to kind of grow together, and you know, there's more success for us if we can give success to the local community, basically. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing. That's the local music scene thing. Another thing is that we're kind of also marketing in a way to kind of at an angle of, you know, you don't need to go to LA to get an LA room. That is something that a lot of people think in the area, and because we are only like 45 minutes south of LA, you know, that's a very common misconception. But we kind of market with that, with, you know, no traffic and lots of parking and lots of space and, you know, basically the stuff that LA can't give you. Something else too that we're also trying to do is that we're also trying to capitalize on the angle of people leaving LA to come down to our studio. So that's a whole nother marketing angle of kind of trying to show people like, hey, you know, we have a good enough quality room where people are driving the 45 minutes the other way to come and use a room down in Orange County rather than, you know, stay local up in LA. So those are kind of three different marketing prongs. And then you constantly have the social media one. And then another one is just our PR. We're just constantly trying to, we're trying to do guest posts on blogs. We were recently on a Discmakers blog. And I believe we have one coming up on Sonic Bids, and those are great just because it kind of is on a more national level. And so, you know, we've had decent David Bendeth from New Jersey come out. And we've had a couple national level guys actually respond to what they've seen. And so those are our bread and butter. So in that order, I'd even say, you know, local music scene's the most important thing. Then we're trying to cast the net and stop people going to LA. And then when people come the other way, we make a big deal about it. And then the national stories, we got a big band in here. Let's, you know, that'll get picked up by Mix Online, and that becomes a national thing. And then in their newsletter and stuff like that. So it's just, you know, it's just every way we can market this place, that's what we're doing.
You know, it's interesting you say you get people coming down from LA, which is not an easy sell. And I know this from experience. My home base was at a studio called Front Page in Glendale for, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 years. So it was a 3-studio facility, and I was usually camped out in one of the rooms. But they had a hard time booking the other studios sometimes, because the perception was Glendale was far away. And if anybody knows LA, they know that Glendale is not that far. Glendale is as far as anything else. So to get someone to come down from Hollywood to overcome that perception, that's really doing a great job, because, you know, the natural tendency is I want to go someplace close.
Yep, exactly. So that is why we try and capitalize and kind of try to show people, like, hey, you know, like, it's the quality of the room is there, you know? So, and you know, 9 times out of 10, if we can get someone to walk in our door, they love the place. Yep. You know, it's our pictures look great, but when you're actually standing in the space, you get it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Cool. I understand. Last question. So what's the best piece of business advice that you've either received from somebody or that you've learned in your time in the business?
That's a good question. I think the most important thing I've learned and been told is that you got to get your foundation solid. In the Orange County market, recording studios tend to kind of be jacks of all trades. You know, you can go to a recording studio and they'll do turnkey, they'll do production, they'll do distribution, marketing, booking. They'll do everything for you. And a couple times I've seen people just spread themselves so thin doing that they have lost the momentum on their main foundation of, you know, their business model. And so I think that's something that we're, you know, doing smartly, is we're going slow. We're just doing one foot in front of the other. We're focusing on building the recording studios business and the sound stages business. You know, it's so easy for us to be like, oh yeah, we could offer distribution. We could offer, you know, a record label. We could do that. And we will, just when the time is appropriate. So I'd say that's probably the biggest thing I've learned, is just know what you're good at and make sure you constantly are giving that enough attention so that doesn't start to slip.
Really good advice. It's very cool. Thank you, Billy.
Thank you.
To find out more about Billy and Hybrid Studios, go to hybridstudiosca.com. That's all one word, Hybrid Studios with an S, CA for California.com, hybridstudios.com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbiointercircle.com. Many thanks to Steve Cherubino, who's the host of the EDM Producer Podcast at edmmr.com. He helps put the show together. Thank you kindly, Steve. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyoinnercircle.com or find it on iTunes or Stitcher. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyoinnercircle.com, you'll find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I'll see you next time.